This is Gil Manser with Word by Word on KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa or streaming online at krcb.org, where tonight's guest is the international diamond expert Charles Johnson, talking about his new novel, Reunion Promise, which includes scenes from Sonoma County in the 1960s and at the Santa Rosa High School reunions in both 1985 and 2001. Dr. Charles J. Johnson grew up in the orchard and vineyard country of Northern California and attended Santa Rosa High School. His backgrounds in geology and mineral economics provided him with the credentials to pursue his passion for adventures to 65 countries spanning the globe. He published more than 50 professional papers and books before turning to his passion, adventure romance writing. The Pennsylvania State University awarded him the Centennial Fellow Award for his accomplishments in mineral economics, and he has been listed in Who's Who in Finance and Industry. Charles lived in Australia, Botswana, Hawaii, Pennsylvania, and Virginia before moving to Rockville, Maryland. He continues to supplement his adventure romance writing with the real stuff, exotic travels with his wife, Xiaodong Wang. Say, is that right?
Xiaodong Wang,
okay. And their young daughter, Michelle, who is 7, right?
Right.
You just told me that.
She thinks she's going on 13, but
yeah,
she's 7.
Yeah, I have a granddaughter at the same age, I understand. Recent travels have taken them to southern China in search of the source of Shangri-La, Cambodia to explore Indiana Jones-type ruins around Angkor Wat, and the stunningly beautiful islands sprinkled across Thailand's Andaman Sea. Charles, I know that the Santa Rosa High School class of 1961 is celebrating their 50th reunion this weekend, and I want to thank you for finding room in your busy schedule to drop into the KRCB studio.
I'm very happy to be here.
I'd like to begin by talking about something you don't expect, the Andaman Islands, where you indicate in your bio you and your family traveled recently. The reason I ask is that until my niece honeymooned in the islands this spring, I hadn't ever heard much about them.
These are really, I would say, about the most beautiful set of islands that you can find anywhere in the world today. It's in southern Thailand, and it's off to the western side of Thailand, the islands. And they're limestone islands, which come vertically straight out of the water, sometimes up to 100 to 200 feet out of the water. And around them, you'll find the turquoise water that's crystal clear. It reminds you of actually looking at aquamarine. And they're loaded with tropical fish, lots of tourists, unfortunately. Some of these islands...
Some of them being you, huh?
Yeah, some of them
and
being
my niece.
Me.
Yeah.
And some of these islands have tunnels that you can go into going by small boats, very small boats. And in the center of the islands, they'll be open, and there'll be monkeys climbing on the walls, and it's like going to a lost paradise.
Ah.
Beautiful islands worth visiting and not that expensive.
Mm-hmm. You'd recommend it.
I highly recommend it. And also where we stayed at a little hotel in Phuket, my daughter had 2 elephants to play with every day.
Uh-huh.
The elephants would meet her at breakfast, and she would ride them and climb on them, feed them bananas. And then they would come to the swimming pool in midday and squirt the kids with water. And in the evening, she would ride out to the beach and go swimming in the ocean with them. They were baby elephants,
right,
about 700
right.
pounds.
Oh, well.
So, great place to
just
vacation.
Little teeny things.
Yeah.
Right. Now, we've known each other for several years. In fact, I read one of the first drafts of this book, and I've noticed the changes, and I'm not going to mention what was there and what's new, et cetera, because no one else has read that piece. But I do know that we talked a lot about you being in Botswana, and your background is being the, I guess, the diamond expert for the president. Is that an accurate description?
I was sent to Botswana to help them negotiate the largest diamond agreement in the world. I was not an expert on diamonds when I arrived in Botswana, but
really?
I had quite a background in minerals, having a PhD in mineral economics and worked with international companies on various minerals and degrees in geology, and I'd studied mining engineering. So that combination made the Botswana government think that I would be a pretty good person to help them get a good deal in the largest diamond deal in the world, which they negotiated with De Beers, and I was the...
Which is in South Africa.
De Beers is also in London, and they have offices all over the world. So I represented the government. I worked with the president a lot, Seretse Khama, a fabulous person, a very far-sighted person. Those of you that haven't heard of Botswana, it has been the fastest-growing country in all of Africa for the last 30 years, which is something to speak about. And it's also the one with the least amount of corruption in Africa. It's a democracy. So it's a delightful place to work. Negotiating.
Give everybody a geographical sense. It's north of South Africa.
It's just north of San Francisco, of South Africa. And
Namibia next to it?
Namibia is on one side, which is also diamond rich. And then on the east side is Zimbabwe. And on the north is Zambia. Mm-hmm. So when I was there, there was fighting going on basically all sides, almost all sides of the country. And they managed to stay neutral. And it's an amazing country that can keep from being drawn into all of the conflicts in Africa, and keep a very honest government going, and also capture the benefits from developing its minerals, which it has done.
And putting it back into infrastructure and education
and in
hospitals,
health,
et cetera. Right.
Yeah. It has the largest share of GDP put into education of any country in Africa. So it's doing a very good job for a small country.
Right. Right. So the other thing that happened is that when we first started with the book, we talked a lot about the character. You want to introduce him to us?
Yes. I came to writing fairly late in life after traveling for many years and working in more than 40 countries. And I became interested in characters that were kind of edgy to start with. I had seen Indiana Jones, which kind of sparked my interest of adventure. Although my real side of me, having traveled the world and going to many of the same places you would see in Indiana Jones movies, is people that jump out of airplanes without parachutes and all of that kind of stuff actually don't survive very long in the real world. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to etch out a character, a real character, that was willing to take calculated risk, adventurous risk around the world, but not silly risk like you see on some of these shows that you see on TV, these so-called reality shows. So I wanted a character that was adventurous but smart, and also one that was a very much more sensitive person towards his female counterpart. And so that's where I started with when I started shaping the character. And I must say that, Gil, you gave me more than 10 pages.
You still typed, have those, yeah.
Yes, typed pages of recommendations of how I could write a novel that would be appealing perhaps for a movie someday. It's always hard to take advice, particularly when you get 10 pages of advice, but I took your advice, and when I finished the next draft, I actually had the opportunity to have a movie producer, Nick Grillo in Hollywood, read the draft, and he immediately called me back and said, "I want it." So whatever you told me seems to have worked. Now, whether I will actually end up getting a movie produced, it's premature to
comment.
Well,
that's about like throwing three coins in a fountain, but we'll see. Yeah.
Yes.
Sounds like you got a start anyway.
I got a start. That's
essentially what, as I recall, I told you is what I tell many people is you need to start with a hook. You need a character that you believe in and an incident that attracts your attention. You had originally, if I recall, started some mountaintop amazing which you described for several pages, you know, with artwork and vista views and hidden helicopter pads and disappearing, I don't know, swimming pools. Am I remembering right?
Maybe that's a little bit of a stretch. Sounds like an 007 movie.
Yeah.
But I was pretty far off the mark when you sent me suggestions. And so I did a lot of restructuring to try to get the hook closer to the front and pull the reader into a story. And I, you know, it is a romance story. You know, as the movie producer, when he called me up, he says that's a five-tissue
really?
Romance
yeah.
story. That's exactly what he told me.
Sort of about halfway through the book, it becomes that.
And that is something that was always in the back of my mind. If I couldn't move the reader a little bit, I think they would put it down very quickly. It is definitely a romance story, but I wanted to bring in a lot more than just a romance. I didn't want to have just a kind of format romance story. I wanted to bring in a lot of the world that I had to have the great opportunity to see, the beautiful vistas in the world, really, the exotic places, and also my life, working and consulting in different countries, both in diamonds and in other areas. I worked in Burma. I worked for the Chinese government in Western China. A lot of these places, the experiences there, I thought, if you could weave that into a compelling story, that would just add to the excitement of having read it. So I've been able to bring some of that experiences of my life in to it, along with the maybe the main character, the protagonist, has more of me than I want to admit.
Well, since we're so close, I want to talk about the Santa Rosa connection. When the character is young, junior, senior in high school, we get to meet him, and he's not what you would say. He's not a, you know, member of the football team or even the chess team, as I'm aware of. He's kind of an outsider. He's done a few goofy things in his life, which got him on the wrong side of the assistant principal. He's known to the police because of that, and has a rep, which is obviously undeserved, at least from his perspective. But he did do those things that they said he did. And one of the things that happens – well, actually, two things happen. He sees a girl with a red ponytail, and just like Charlie Brown, he becomes smitten. And he also has an opportunity to solve a geometry problem that's presented by his teacher who is – that's supposedly unsolvable. And those two things really change his opinion of himself and really the rest of his life. So tell us more about that.
It really happened. The geometry teacher was kind of showing off to the class one day, and he said, well, you know, you kids, if you want to try something really hard, here's one that you won't be able to solve. And he gave it to us on, I believe it was a Friday. And somebody asked, maybe it was myself, I don't recall, what do you give us if we solve it? And he said, of course, you get an A+. You're equivalent to a college level student in math. So I went home. I worked all day, and I worked all weekend long in my father's service station and found a solution to it, brought it into class the following week. I was extremely proud of myself. And the teacher, when I showed and demonstrated this on the class, was horrified. Instead of congratulating me, I could see that I had actually made him very angry. Probably because he had to give me an A+, which was, I think, the only A+ I ever got in my life, by the way. And I also met him after class in line going to lunch, and I went to talk to him about that, thinking that I would get some kudos for what I had done. And I was very disappointed that at the time he actually was not happy that I had been able to solve it. Now, to be honest, I couldn't prove the solution, which is something you have to do in geometry.
But he hadn't asked for that.
He hadn't asked for that. But I did get my A+ in the class, and so I'll always remember that. The girl described in the novel, she was, in fact, my coming-of-age romance. She was a brilliant girl, probably the smartest in the Santa Rosa school system in high school. And
Known as a brain at the time.
She was known as a brain, and for some reason, she quickly became enamored by me, although I worked very hard to get her to notice me. I was definitely not considered a brain in high school, and I was very mischievous in high school, as some teenagers are. I was always trying to test the system to see how far I could push it. And it was the conservative period of the 1950s, you have to put it in context, the late 1950s. Where girls had to cover...
Eisenhower still in office.
Yes, Eisenhower era, and girls had to wear dresses that covered their knees. And I also remember in dances where they would come around with a ruler to sure that it would fit between you and your partner. But
the world was going to H if they didn't, right?
Yes, it was really something. And then there was Elvis Presley, which was really shocking many of the parents around that his gyrations on stage. So it's an exciting time for teenagers, but not so for the conservative establishment.
What was Santa Rosa like then?
It was really it was a delightful town to grow up in. It was truly a small town at that stage. Farming was still quite significant in the area. There were apple orchards. I remember the smell of these apple orchards when I would drive out towards the Russian River, and prune orchards. And it was really at a small town level. To just give you an example, my father had a little service station, Johnson Brothers Service Station.
Where was that?
On Sebastopol Avenue, right near the railroad tracks.
Uh-huh.
And he would carry credit with farmers for the year. If the farmer didn't have money, he would wait until whenever they had money. And some of the farmers would come in and fill their own car, and they would actually go and fill out the bill for themselves and then leave, without us ever having seen the farmer. He would just come in and do it. There was that much of a trust of the people you knew. It really was small town America. It was a pretty town, the way it was laid
out. Before the freeway.
It was before the freeway. The freeway was built right at the end of the 60s, into the 50s. So that was just coming in at the end. I used to ride a bicycle, a big balloon-tired bicycle all over town, and that was really a very accessible town. That was a reflection of, I think, the era that we grew up in. And the 60s was a very turbulent era as Vietnam War took off and we had lots of change. And then the growth of the population has been dramatic in this region.
Mm-hmm.
But I must say, I just drove through Santa Rosa this morning. I came in from the East Coast. It's still a very pretty town downtown. You see lots of nice little restaurants, and I can see some of the old stores that I used to visit.
The novel works on multiple levels. In fact, I remember reading on one of the websites that a man wrote in and says, you know, I thought this was going to be a chick flick kind of book, but it wasn't. It got me. It engaged me. It made me want to continue on. But it's not the typical, prototypical hero character, you know, who... You know, you were mentioning Indiana Jones swinging on vines and chasing off snakes, et cetera, et cetera. This guy doesn't do that.
No.
He slays demons of a different type.
Yeah, I really wanted to have one that had a kind of a different aspect. I wanted him adventurous, and I wanted the protagonist to be successful. But I really wanted him to be somebody who could make great commitment for things that were very, very important to that person. And that was, a person that reminded me a little bit of the character was also in the book Bridges of Madison County, Robert Kincaid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a photographer for, I believe, National Geographic, shows up in the small...
Portrayed by Clint Eastwood.
Portrayed by, a great actor. And... he was a very romantic character, but he was not capable of making great sacrifice for this
or
woman.
Commitment.
Yeah,
right.
Or commitment right. for the woman that he met. And so I liked the character, but I didn't like so much. I didn't want a character that wouldn't make commitment. If the commitment was worth it, how far could a person really commit in life? And I worked hard in this novel to show just how far a person might be able to commit. Interesting sidelight. I had an early draft read in Japan by a publisher there who had one of their reviewers review the novel. And the person came back after, I don't want to say too much about the plot, but the review said it's a well-written, it's a tight novel. He liked the protagonist, but he couldn't believe that people could actually make that kind of commitment. And maybe that's the cultural difference. I thought between maybe how we see commitment here and perhaps at least among some Japanese men.
Well, this brings us to the reunion part of this, the fact that it begins with the protagonist going back to Santa Rosa High School's 25th reunion, 1981, am I remembering right? And you describe the characters that you meet there, some of them from, who are familiar and remember well, others who don't look like people you knew at all now. You could tell they cover up their name badge, so you can't guess who they used to be. And obviously that's – how many reunions have you been to now?
I went to my 10th reunion, and I actually went to my 30th and 40th reunions. I find reunions very interesting for a short period of time. I wouldn't want to go every year and find out what people did for during the year.
Are you doing it at the Flamingo? Is that right?
Yeah, we're doing it at the Flamingo.
It has to be there, right?
And there are 88 graduates coming from the class of 61, so that's exciting.
How many were in the class originally?
About 450 or so.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about high school reunions, which more people go to high school reunions than any other reunion, by the way, is whereas in college, if I go back to a university reunion, I pretty much know how the graduates are going to do. Most of the graduates during my era when I graduated in graduate school, they were all pretty successful. Mm-hmm. So you're basically seeing a life that you knew that they were going to live, maybe a different job, but pretty predictable. When you go back to a high school reunion, it's a surprise. The wallflower that you never noticed in school went on to be a jet setter traveling around the world and living in England and where have you. And some of the students that you felt were just the most outstanding leaders of the class really did not go very far.
Geographically, or
maybe in their career. And I'm not saying this as a criticism. I think whatever somebody does in life, you know, if you do it well and you're happy, I think that is an important contribution.
Well, in the time, we were talking about this a little earlier, but in the time of the late 50s, you know, first year of the 60s, were people expected to leave Sonoma County?
No. It was a time where many of the graduates took over their family businesses. Those that took over farms ended up with nice vineyards and probably make a lot more money than I ever made.
We had the JC, but no Sonoma State.
You had the JC then, and students went to JC. Some of them, the best students, went to places like Berkeley. But the majority have stayed right in the region, mm-hmm. and I think contributed a lot to what Sonoma County and Santa Rosa has become. Today, students graduating from high school, I think it's a very different activity and expectations. Students are going to go far and wide. That's critical today to actually find work.
Right.
Students are much more likely to go international, to end up in Washington, D.C., or where have you. Very few of my graduating class ended up far more than a couple of hundred miles from Santa Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they have lived very fulfilling lives. I'm not saying that as a criticism. When you look, the enjoyable part is to see what they have done to build the kind of county that we now have and that I so much enjoy returning to.
Now, you're bringing your wife and daughter with you to this one.
Yes.
What are your expectations?
Yes. I married a woman that I met in China who came to the U.S. and did her Ph.D. at Berkeley. She graduated from the leading university of China, which is called Tsinghua, which is where the leadership of China comes from. She is a Chinese citizen, and we've been married for 17 years. So she's much younger than myself, as we have a 7-year-old daughter, and I'm in my heading towards 70. But I wanted to bring my wife and daughter back to this to let them see something that I have talked to them about. Mm-hmm. They know my wife knows the novel. She encouraged me to write it. I wanted them to see in the flesh and blood, so to speak, some of the characters that I have used directly or indirectly in my novels, and also to see a little bit of Santa Rosa and Sonoma County. And that kind of puts real flesh on the stories that I have been telling them. So it was important to bring them here. And important for my daughter, she loves to travel. She's been to 17 countries with me. She's
wow.
a real adventurer.
She has her own passport?
She has on her second passport. Uh-huh. She's been on 50 flights about. Loves to travel. A little Indiana Jones. She was recently exploring the ruins in Cambodia,
right.
hunting for spitting cobras. That was what she really wanted to find, and she climbed all
through. But there's no piece of glass between her and the cobras.
This is the real stuff there.
Yeah.
I mean, the real worry was in the remote areas. I was worried about stepping on mines.
Really,
I wasn't so worried about the snakes. But I think it'll be a really memorable experience for all of us. I plan to dance with my daughter and wife at the reunion, the formal affair, which will be Saturday night. So looking forward to that.
Do you have on your Rolex watch?
The Rolex is something that I have never had a Rolex.
Oh, okay.
But I actually have on the watch that I describe in the novel.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't actually scratched by a lion as in the novel, although in Africa, I have had some pretty close calls because I did live in the Kalahari and I had a Land Rover. And whenever I had a few days off, I would take off, load up with all the fuel I could carry and water and take off into the Kalahari.
Are you just supposed to stop at one of those marked places and dig out the ostrich eggs filled with water?
Yes, if you knew the places. I actually, at one stage, talking about the ostrich egg cells, I tried to cross the Kalahari before they had a road. And I had two other
landmarks. And before GPS, I guess.
No GPS, anything like that. And
right.
We didn't make it. We lost all of our tires because of the sharp spikes of the burnt-out bushes that you, from the fires in the Kalahari, it leaves spikes sticking up in the sand, and that's really great for tires. But anyway, near the center of the Kalahari, we came upon three bush people, the real bush people, which no longer really exist. And I remember a woman coming up to—
Is that the one that used the click language?
Yes.
Yes.
And a woman came up. She had on an animal skin. She came up to the Land Rover or the Land Cruiser, and she looked in the back of it. She's just very, very curious, and looked in the back, and she saw some wine bottles. We carried wine with us because in the evenings in the Kalahari we'd have a sip of wine. But we wouldn't leave anything in the Kalahari. We'd carry everything back out. She saw some empty wine bottles in a carton, and she became very excited. And I happened to be traveling with an anthropologist who could understand the click language, which is very exciting to listen to but almost impossible for Westerners to speak. And so he said, well, she wants those. And
Are we talking about that movie with the Coca-Cola bottle?
It's like the Coca-Cola bottle in a way. But this is true. So I traded two French wine bottles, empty, for two ostrich egg shells, which she took
those
off.
And they're about 9-10 inches tall?
They're about 8 inches, yeah. And there's a hole in the top, and then they have a way of fastening it to their belt. I actually have it in my home.
Mm-hmm.
And they carry their water. They're very efficient for water, but she liked the wine bottles better. So she attached a wine bottle on each side of her hips, and she has this leather skin that she's wearing around. And I remember watching her walk kind of into the sunset with these two wine bottles attached to her hips. She was obviously seemed very content, and I had these two beautiful carved ostrich egg shells, which I was holding, and I kept wondering, I know some anthropologist is going to enter the Kalahari to find the last bushman someday, and they're going to spot her carrying French wine bottles. And so I had this kind of a funny feeling in my stomach, have I destroyed this
society? Oh, they're French wine. You didn't mention that.
Yeah, the French wine bottles.
Because none of that South African stuff.
A South African wine is very good, but these happen to be French. And so, but that was a very touching to see these people. I also ran into a small village in the middle of the Kalahari where there was only two or three items from the outside world. One was a key that a woman had around her neck. The other was a small knife that
just
the chief
had.
Just
a metal key?
Just a metal key, rusted key, small knife. And the chief's or the head man's wife, I think his wife, had on a dress, so kind of a dress. It was really all tattered. But nobody else in the village of about 20 had any, I think, leather clothing around them. The thing that struck me when I met them is they were very quiet, and I gave them some oranges and cookies that I had in the Land Rover, is that I also noticed that almost all of the children had a lot of head lice, and you could tell that a little bit of medical treatment would really go a long way to people in these very severe circumstances that they were living.
Mm-hmm.
But the real Bushmen are basically gone now. Most of them have moved into to closer to towns and villages.
Right.
So there's almost
and they've
none
intermarried
left.
With others, I assume.
And there's some intermarriage. Yeah. And that's it's sad in a way that you see the culture disappearing because there are many beautiful aspects of the Bush people there.
Did you see that they had discovered a new tribe in the Amazon that had never been had contact with?
I saw that recently, yes.
Western world before.
And
I've never had similar thoughts.
I've never been to the Amazon. I once took a helicopter deep into the Papua New Guinea jungles,
mm-hmm.
and I had some spare time and had a spare helicopter.
Sure. keep it around my waist, right?
Yeah, sometimes. I was evaluating a nickel deposit there for some company. And since we had spare time, the pilot said, let's go see if we can find something really, really strange. And this is a really thick jungle. And he flew up deep into the jungle in Papua New Guinea, and we found a crevice in the jungle. that went down several hundred feet. There was cliffs on either side to a small river. And so he dropped that helicopter down, and the blades, I was sure, were going to hit the side. I mean, I was really very nervous, into this crevice in the middle of the jungle. And we got out of the helicopter, and within a few minutes, a man came out without much in the way of, with no clothing except for a bone through his nose and a little something wrapped around his waist. And it was really a very surreal event to sit there and have somebody step out that maybe had never encountered somebody from the outside world.
And you
before.
Started a cargo cult.
I don't know, but it was really, my heart
you
was really
building.
You remember
what I'm referring to, yes. The Papua New Guineans who worshipped the airplanes that would fly over during World War II.
They did for decades.
Yeah.
But that was an experience that I'll never forget.
You are listening to Word by Word Conversation with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org. Tonight's conversation is the international diamond expert and world traveler Charles Johnson talking about his new mystery romance novel, Reunion Promise, and especially the scenes from Sonoma County in the 1960s and at the Santa Rosa High School reunions in both 1985 and 2001. So stay tuned as Word by Word continues on KRCB 91.1 FM. Well, let's come back to Reunion Promise, 1985. We've talked about 1961, but in 1985, the hero goes to the reunion with a specific goal in mind. He's really trying to discover what happened to Tracy. He assumes she will be there.
Yes.
Now, I don't want to give away a lot of plots. I'm going to leave this up to you to how to present.
I don't want to give away too much, but he has become very successful in the diamond business in Africa. And he gets an invitation to the reunion, and he has memories of this first romance.
And the grapes.
And when they parted, she had promised that she would contact him basically when the time was right.
Now, when they parted, you mean at the end of the school year, isn't that when it happened?
The last time he saw her.
Okay.
And I can't tell you what the situation was there because that's part of what you need to read to find out.
Right.
But when he last saw her, she told him not to contact her, that she would contact him, and she promised, when the time was right. It's 25 years later, and he has not heard word one from her.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't stay around moaning and worrying about his high school sweetheart, but he definitely does remember a romance.
Not attached. He has a convenient female who comes and visits and uses the tiger skin as a rug.
Yes. He's not a celibate person through life.
Right. She likes to hold on to the teeth.
He does. You definitely have read it. He definitely has lived life as a single, successful person would. But he does remember this romance of his, coming-of-age romance, and when he gets the invitation to the reunion, he thinks, going back to that reunion, I could see what has happened to her life. And that was a compelling reason for him to return, to just find out what happened to her. His expectations are low, but he just wants to see. As is true with many of the people listening to this show, they will return to a reunion just to find out what happened to a past romance, somebody that they fell in love with when they were a teenager. Now,
apparently that's I went to a college reunion a couple of years ago, and when I was doing an article about it, I found out that that's actually one of the main reasons people come back is to reconnect with old boyfriends or girlfriends, and many times they're hoping that they're unattached now.
Yes. and he has these...
Or even attached, I
guess. He has some expectations.
Right.
And he returns to the reunion, and what he will discover at that reunion will change his entire life for the rest of the novel.
Right.
And it is...
Right away, too. I mean,
right
it happens
away.
That evening.
It is and there is a mystery that he must solve, and that will carry you to the end. The ending of the novel, which obviously I would not give away right now is something that eluded me for a long time when I was writing it. I had a different ending.
Yeah, we had discussions about that.
And then, you know, one day it just popped into my mind. And I remember first writing it down. I was misspelling every word. I was so nervous to get the idea down for the ending. I was afraid I was going to lose it. And so I just quickly wrote something down, and then I naturally went back to revise it. And so I'm very happy with the ending, and I'd be very disappointed if anybody who does read my novel, if they peeked at the ending first. I would be very disappointed to hear that.
So sort of like Psycho, when after the first 15 minutes, you're not allowed in the theater, and you can't give away the ending under penalty of Alfred Hitchcock's Ghost coming back.
Yes, because it is something that I'm really happy with the way the ending comes out, but it would give away so much if somebody looked at that last chapter.
Mm-hmm. So don't do that.
Don't do that.
We had a writing contest locally, and one of the young winners, 14-year-old girl, came in, and she had this list of do's and don'ts about how you should read a book. And for instance, if a book is part of a series, you have to read them in order. And one of the things was you can't read the end first. So you're right on with her. Let's go back. I want to start. I don't want to give away too much. I'm kind of hanging around the beginning of the novel. But one of the things that happens is, since he's working, he's in the diamond industry. He has a business selling diamonds. Is that basically it?
Yes.
And he's called to what's called a site.
Yes.
So give a little bit about that. I thought that was fascinating.
Yes. This is the real stuff. Diamonds traditionally have been sold by De Beers, mm-hmm. the diamond cartel.
You refer to as the syndicate.
The syndicate, although this is a work of fiction, I want to remind people. But I was an alternate director on their largest subsidiary, so I actually did see how the syndicate operated up close and personal. 10 times a year, they invite approximately 200 of the most important people in diamonds in the world, sellers of diamonds, to a site. Those 200 buyers show up. They give De Beers.
This is in London?
In London.
Okay.
It also can be elsewhere. But historically, it was in London. And then they give a list of the diamonds that they would like to purchase. And they are given a box of diamonds.
The people who come in, the companies represented, give a list of
what they want.
For. Now, this is by size, color, whatever.
Yes.
Grade.
Grade. And they're up to 4,000 categories.
Wow.
They are given a box at the site with their diamonds in a box. And individual diamonds, larger diamonds, are in little envelopes. And you can go into a little room on your own without somebody looking over your shoulder, and you can check over the diamonds that you have received at the site.
With a bright light and a loop, I assume.
You look at that and a loop. You can take, historically, this is how it operated, you can take the whole box of diamonds, or you cannot take the box of diamonds.
Either all or none?
That was historically how. It has changed somewhat today in recent years because of more competition in the business. And the syndicate's goal was to sell all of the diamonds that it received from mines all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has all of these categories and sizes that it's trying to get back into the marketplace. And the buyers may not be asking for exactly what they have to sell.
Uh-huh.
So the syndicate will spread around, will give you part of what you want and part of what it would like you to sell also. So you may not get everything that you want. But that was historically too bad.
If you say no too many times, are you not invited back?
Yes, you just don't get the invitation.
Uh-huh.
And that, going to a site, is worth a substantial amount of money for the diamonds that you are going to pick up there that nobody else can get in the world. So you're very honored to be invited. This is historically through the period in this novel. So you definitely didn't want to turn down diamonds. And those that did during that period often did not receive an invitation, which was catastrophic to their business because mm-hmm. then you have to go to other markets or secondary markets to buy diamonds and you're going to pay more for them or you're going to get into these areas in
the blood diamonds.
Yeah, and blood diamonds, by the way, is about maybe 2 to 4% of the world diamond supplies. And it does reflect what goes on in some localized areas, but has nothing to do with the real business of diamonds.
Gotten a lot of publicity because of some very high-profile figures.
In fact, one of the scenes in Blood Diamonds of the...
Which was a horrible movie. Don't go see it.
It is. It's not a very good movie. No. The protagonist meeting some woman on a dinner or dance floor in Sierra Leone, although it wasn't actually filmed there, one evening. Actually, that happened to me. I was sitting there having dinner with a diamond person in Sierra Leone. We were down there looking at some diamond mines. And sure enough, a reporter from some Africa, a blonde reporter, approached me because she was trying to find out what was going on in diamonds. And mm-hmm. So the setting in that movie happened to be surreal when I saw that setting, which is fairly similar. But the movie is not a very good movie. It is not accurate as far as reflecting how the real diamond business works for the 95%+, which is tough, hard business. Mm-hmm. And you better know what you're doing in this business or you will not do very well.
I remember talking with you before about how diamond colors change as fashion does. And is that somewhat dictated by, quote, the syndicate or
yes.
by what diamonds they provide? So if there's what are some of the colors? Pink?
Yes, it changes, yellow,
and purple.
And sometimes you use an advertising technique to make a diamond that's hard to sell more appealing, like call it champagne.
Mm-hmm.
If it's kind of a brownish
yellow tinge to it.
One that was traditionally hard to sell, all of a sudden if you call it champagne, well, that kind of is appealing.
Right.
The other thing, I was on the advertising committee of the of diamonds worldwide to find out what was happening. And you do see different countries have very different taste, whether you're in Japan or the U.S. or Europe. There are different tastes on how you would market diamonds. There are different things that will evoke the feelings that will make somebody want to buy
a
diamond.
So in addition to South Africa and the countries that are close by there, Russia, mm-hmm. what other parts of the world produce diamonds of gem quality?
The big player in recent years has been coming out of Canada, which is something...
Which part of Canada?
Northern Canada. There's a lot of these stable platforms that have a lot of diamonds in them. And until the 80s, we didn't even know about them.
I'm trying to remember my geology, but they are usually found in...
Kimberlands.
Yes.
They're like an ice cream cone. They come up from more than 100 miles depth in the ocean, under the crust. And they look like a cross-section of an ice cream cone. And so you're really tapping deep into the earth when you are looking at a diamond kimberlite.
Right.
And then as the kimberlites weather away, the diamonds in the kimberlite then will go down streams and you find them in concentration in streams. But the really rich deposits usually are in large kimberlites. And the two richest ones sit in Botswana.
Mm.
One's called Arapa and the other one's called Joneng. And that has transformed that country, not just because of the diamonds, but because it has an honest government.
Well, that's right. And that's one of the things we talked about is because the neighbors, to be polite and not mention them specifically, one of them takes the money all to their family and then says to heck with the rest of the people.
Yes. And this, when I was working there, I worked under the minister from mines, who was a woman, the first PhD, a woman in the country.
Which is unusual.
Yes, still going strong, Dr. Gustavo Chiappi, who's impeccably honest. We would fly around the world. She was the largest diamond player in the world, and we flew economy class because the government during that period would not let us even fly business class because they were trying to save every cent that they could. It was really very remarkable. And she would not accept private jet planes that were offered to her or to go on private yachts. She wouldn't accept any of that. Just a very honest, very impeccably honest person. It's so rare to see that anywhere in the world,
mm-hmm.
including perhaps in the U.S. at times, that
right.
level of honesty.
Right. Well, we can see that every day in the newspaper.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, we've had some big scandals in Santa Rosa in the last year or two regarding people who everyone trusted and now are headed to jail. So.
Yes. I remember one time sitting in my office in Botswana, when the permanent secretary, the minister makes all of the major decisions, but the person who actually runs the ministries is the permanent secretary, the structure. And one day the permanent secretary, a London-educated lawyer, came dashing into my office and he says, Charles, I finally somebody finally offered me a bribe. I've been waiting all these years. And he thought it was so funny that this company had actually thought that he would take a bribe, that he actually was running down the halls after they left, after he threw them out.
Well, maybe they were used to dealing with one of the other countries, right?
Yes, and there were particularly a lot, unfortunately, in West Africa. There was a lot of corruption, but small-time corruption. But still, you know, it really ruined the countries when you see the end results of the money being funneled into other places. But Botswana is one that I the minister often told me. She says, you know why we're never in the news? Because we don't do anything bad. And, you know, there wasn't anything you know, really bad that the country did. It's a remarkable place.
Now, you mentioned to me that this book kind of took over your life.
Yep.
So what do you mean by that?
Yes. One of the wonderful things about writing is you go on an adventure that you don't know where it's actually going to take you. At least that was my case. As I wrote the novel, as it got into my head, I would go to sleep, put myself to sleep at night, thinking of parts of the novel. And when I woke up in the morning, there would be answers for me. And I would get up and I would rush out, grab a cup of coffee, sit down and start typing early in the morning, sometimes 5 in the morning, because the idea of what to do with the plot. So it's a wonderful adventure for people that really have the time to do it. And if they will also realize they probably will not make a lot of money doing this, it is something that is one of the nicest feelings that I can talk of any activity that I've done in my life, is writing and creating and then rewriting and creating and seeing where the novel will take you. You know, I laid out an outline of what I wanted to write, and then as I got into the story sometimes would take over and almost guide me into another area, and that was quite rewarding. Plus, there were other people like Gil right here who would send me 10 pages of telling me where I should go. And
then you'd tell me where I should go.
Yeah, no, I would tell other writers to not have thick skins when you get advice from professionals, because if you have thick skins, I think if you're a new writer entering the field, I think you have a hopeless future. You really do need to listen to other professionals that can give you very useful advice, if you can find those that will take the time to give you advice on how to tighten up your novel, how to get plots that really will zing. Otherwise, it is a very, very difficult field to break into.
You have another book you're in the middle of or finished?
I've been to China about 40 times since 1985, so I've traveled around there a lot. I met my wife there, and we fell in love in China and dated it at a time in China when...
In a grape orchard?
Right. She was not interested in marrying an American at all because she was with a successful family in China, but love trumps everything. And so we dated at a time in China when Chinese did not really date foreigners. It was not looked on very well. And so the experiences of my 40 trips to China and also meeting and dating my wife gave me some background to work with if I wanted to do a romance set in China. But the thing that that also tied into that is when I was about 12 years old, I found a sea chest in my father's, in our garage where we lived. And the sea chest was full of pictures of China, a few from Hawaii, of Shanghai. And I went to my mother and said, where did all of these pictures come from? And it turned out that my father, who was a very nice, gentle, conservative...
The one with the garage.
Running a service station in Santa Rosa. When he was 17 years old, alone, he had traveled around the Pacific and gone to Shanghai. And he did meet an interesting woman when he was in Shanghai. And that gave me the idea for a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And from there... And
got your writer's spark going.
With my experience meeting my wife there and the kind of the exotic flavors of the Orient, I just started writing. And so I have several chapters of that, but a long ways to go.
Very good. Well, thank you. This has been Charles J. Johnson, I should say, The book is Reunion Promise, and is it reunionpromise.com?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the website.
That's the website, and there's lots of information there. Thank you so much.
And thank you for having me.
Here at KRCB, we have dozens of books cross our desk each month and have only had time to share a select few with our KRCB listeners. So we are starting a new feature on our Wednesday evening literary shows. I want to welcome Barbara Quick, a writer and contributor to the New York Times, who will be sharing brief book reviews on a regular basis.
Not to love and lavish praise on Gary Steingart's new novel would almost seem to be an act of cultural heresy. Anointed by The New Yorker as one of the 20 best writers under 40, Steingart has entered a literary empyrean where he enjoys immunity to the slings and arrows of grumpy readers. And yet, I am not in love with his novel, Super Sad True Love Story, which just came out in paperback, even though Michiko Kakutani of The New York Times hailed it as one of the 10 best books of 2010. Steingart's novel is set in a future that seems just around the corner in an America run by corporations and owned by China. Crypto-fascism and illiteracy prevail. Sexuality has become a thoroughly public matter, arbitrated by the fashion industry and a Facebook descendant called Global Teen, which relentlessly publishes ratings of everyone's, I can't say the word on the radio, let us say, doability. A literary heir to Woody Allen's nerdy protagonist in Sleeper, Steingart's alter ego, Lenny Abramoff, finds himself struggling and adrift in this morally and literally bankrupt world, looking for love and hoping for immortality. Gary Steingart has made literary hay out of being washed onto these shores in the latest wave of Russian Jewish immigrants to parents he both resents and reveres. A desire to understand the immigrant experience in all the glory of its possibilities for angst and humor is the heart and soul, at least so far, of Steingart's imaginative quest. Super Sad True Love Story is a postmodern hodgepodge of emails, diary entries, and first-person narrative, all of it larded over with irony as thick as the layer of fat on my mother's brisket. Call me old-fashioned, but I like a story with characters I don't want to leave when the book is done. Characters who are more than caricatures, more than a set of funhouse mirrors in service of the author's gift for satire. Steingart himself invokes the term hysterical realism to describe his writing style. My beef with him is that, like his heroes Tolstoy and Chekhov, the man really can write. Ironically, he's written the sort of end-of-literature novel that both he and his alter ego, Lenny Abramoff, decry. I want this clearly brilliant writer to gird himself up and take more risks, to do his part to keep alive the literary novel that he and I both love so well. This is Barbara Quick.
You have been listening to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org, where tonight's guest was the international diamond expert and world traveler Charles Johnson, talking about his new novel Reunion Promise, which includes scenes from Sonoma County in the 1960s and at the Santa Rosa High School reunions in both 1985 and 2001. Our sound engineer for the show is Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. Thanks for listening and sharing Word by Word with your friends and family on KRCB 91.1 FM or online at krcb.org. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.